from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, April the 24th, 2020. And once again, we are going to focus a significant part of the show today on the proposal now withdrawn to close three campuses of the Vermont State College system, and the what will happen now, the sort of follow-up. Just a week ago today, Jeb Spaulding, the chancellor of that system, put out a proposal to close the two campuses of Northern Vermont University in Lyndon and Johnson, and then also close the Vermont Technical College, what's been their main campus, in Randolph Center. That drew a lot of consternation and criticism and general unhappiness with a wide swath of Vermont people, graduates of the colleges, students at the colleges, certainly staff and faculty who were looking at possibly 500 job losses, and community members who really rely on these colleges in small towns as linchpins of the local and regional economies. So Chancellor Jeb Spaulding withdrew that proposal after it came under heavy fire. And now the question is, the question sort of goes to the legislature about how to manage the future of these state colleges. And we are going to have a key legislator on this morning. Senator Phil Baruth is the chair of the Senate Education Committee and has been right in the thick of the at least initial discussions here in the first few days since that that grenade got tossed by the chancellor. So we're going to be talking with him in our first half hour. In the second half hour, we're going to bring in Bruce Post. Bruce is a longtime Vermonter who has served in a variety of capacities in government, often as doing research and policy development for people like former Governor Richard Snelling, Robert Stafford, and others and frequently in education policy. So he is very familiar with a lot of the history surrounding higher education funding, and we're going to talk with him in the second half hour of the program. Later on in the second hour of today's show, we're going to bring in three folks who are involved in an effort to help out Vermont's musicians, many of whom are really struggling these days because all their gigs have dried up. You know, nobody's gathering in public venues where you typically go to hear music, and therefore there's no work for these folks. And there's an effort underway by a luthier, that's someone who makes stringed instruments, a bow maker to make a violin, and then raffle it off with proceeds going to help some of our musicians in Vermont. So that's a interesting and positive activity that folks are engaging in the face of this coronavirus pandemic. And I just wanted to wrap the week up on sort of a positive note here. So we're going to have that conversation in the second hour of today's program. But first, let's get right into it with Senator Phil Baruth, who I believe is on the line with me this morning. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Dave. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine, and I thank you very much for joining me. So I think I've got the basic facts and figures of the state college situation correct as so far as I got into them in that little intro there. Tell me if I'm wrong about anything, but I gather that it's now in your fellow legislators, administration officials' hands to sort of take the lead, develop a plan, try to get these schools in shape for a future in which they're likely will be, at least a foreseeable future, in which there will likely be fewer students around.
Yeah, I just would only change one thing in what you said, and that is the legislature did not vote to take this decision away from the trustees. We prevailed upon them to postpone it and to work with us on a more thoughtful, measured approach, and they've agreed to do that, but we haven't so far stepped in and legally taken the responsibility. It's just now a voluntary partnership, I would put it.
Okay. And so the legislature and your committee in particular, I gather, will you be sort of, if there is legislation developing out of this, actually, let me back it up further and ask you first, do you expect that there will be legislation developing to sort of encapsulate a plan to go forward with whatever needs to happen with the state colleges?
I would say no for two reasons. One is that the timeline on this is going to be incredibly short for what we're talking about, which is an attempt to come up with a new creative plan that could perhaps save one, two, or three of these residential campuses. So the clock is running in a really, really crazy way. Jeb Spalding, I think everyone agrees, rushed a plan out, not specifically to disenfranchise students, faculty, alumni, community members, but because they were facing such crushing debts. So COVID-19 has accelerated that. So they are looking at a $25 million deficit for the coming year. They are looking at perhaps without aid, they wouldn't be able to meet payroll in June. So it's a very, very rapid window that we're working in. With COVID-19, the legislature is operating, but we're operating at a fraction of the speed that we normally do. So those two things together make it very unlikely that this would be dealt with in statute or in a bill. So what we're thinking about is a couple of different things. First of all, the trustees gave us a set of numbers that are alarming and may well be the actual state of affairs. But, you know, in these things, you usually want another set of eyes. You want to verify the financial situation first. So our Senate leadership has been talking with the treasurer for Vermont, Beth Pierce. And the question is, does she have the bandwidth in the next couple of weeks, maybe in the middle of COVID-19, to help us verify that financial state of affairs? That's kind of the first thing. I hope that she'll be able to do that and help us. But, you know, she has a full plate, as we all do. But we will be getting some kind of second opinion on the numbers. Then beyond that, I think rather than having a legislative committee like mine try in 4 or 5 months to come up with a detailed plan, we would be looking to bring in and put to work some very highly specialized professionals, people who make their living assessing the viability of these kind of institutions, and people who are experienced and practiced at turning them around in this environment. And by this environment, I mean a world where, you know, instruction is increasingly online. We have regional online powerhouses like Southern New Hampshire University. We have New York with free tuition. So we're competing in 5 or 6 different ways at a time when our own demographics are dropping for this age group. So we need creative thinkers from this particular space to come in and help us work that plan out very quickly.
And the so these would be sort of professional consultants or whatever in higher education. Is that the idea?
Yes, because, you know, people accuse the legislature of a certain amount of arrogance, and maybe in some situations it's merited. But we are smart enough to know that we are not the people to redesign the system in 4 months. The trustees have been working on their plan for a much longer time. Admittedly, we didn't like it, and the community didn't like it. So we're going to try for something else. But there's a real hard stop in terms of a deadline, and that is we need to have a decision of some sort before the next year, because you need to be recruiting people, and you need to be able to recruit students in an honest way. You need to be able to represent to them that the institution that you're recruiting them for is going to be around for the long term. So the basic deadline we're working toward is the end of this year, that is Christmas. And the idea will be to try to get a workable answer out to everybody with significant community input by Christmas.
But, I mean, right now, if you're a senior in high school and you are looking at a few different schools, one of which is, say, you know, NVU Linden, let's just as yep. one example, and you know, you have a couple of other possibilities, you know, maybe one of the New York State schools, or you know, in Massachusetts or whatever, and you are, and you know, your family's in a budgetary situation where you're basically under some urging to try to stick with public schools, let's say, just for now, for this example, and the because they tend to be less expensive overall. So right now you're thinking, well, gee, I probably ought to scratch this NVU Linden off my list because I don't know if it's going to be open in the fall.
Well, I hope people wouldn't do that. If the plan ultimately is to keep Linden open, then to me that says the legislature stands behind it and we're going to fund that plan at the requisite level. So that's the 64,000.
Okay, but right, the key word in that sentence, it sounded to me like, was if. The first word was if.
Well, and again, back to the deadline of December. So if you're a student who is trying to decide right now, we can't say with any confidence what the final answers will be. But mm-hmm. the idea is to have them by December so that when kids start selecting colleges, when especially Vermonters start looking around for what they're going to be doing next year, we will be in a position to make honest representations about all of the campuses that will remain in the system.
Okay. One other question I have, it's a little, I don't know, maybe more vague or less definite, but I feel like I've learned over the past week with all the conversations I've had on this radio program and just on the phone with people and so on about the state college system is that it actually fills a lot of roles beyond just educating undergraduates in terms of, you know, providing major artistic and cultural hubs for the communities in which these places, these schools are located. You know, everything from sporting events to concerts and, you know, gallery shows and you name it tend to be based at these schools. They are, in some cases, key sources of recruiting for, you know, NVU for Vermont's educational system. A lot of our teachers coming out of those schools. And, of course, you know, we have employers in the central Vermont area who have a big pipeline from VTC into their onto their floor, you know, their shop floors and so on. And I'm just wondering, do you feel like that those additional roles beyond just educating undergraduates have gotten sufficient acknowledgement up to now? And if you were to give them more acknowledgement, would that justify, you know, more funding, frankly, from state government?
The answers are no and yes. No, I don't think at all that community impact and economic development impact were given enough consideration in the chancellor's plan. I think everybody agrees on that. And yes, I do think that now that the legislature has been faced with the reality of potentially three campuses going out, there is a renewed urgency in the legislature, House and Senate, to make sure that communities don't, I would say, unnecessarily experience this sort of dislocation economically. So what I mean by that is it may turn out that we're not able to save all three campuses, but everybody understands that if you let all three go out, you are going to have three smoking holes in three different regions of the state. And I think that struck us all as crazy, frankly. And so our Economic Development Committee, as well as our Education Committee and our Appropriations Committee, we will all be very actively involved in the final decisions. And ultimately, the trustees and the legislature will try to work on their bailiwick is making sure their campuses are viable. Our bailiwick is the state. And hopefully we come up with a solution that can work for both.
Well, I'm going to preface this next question by saying I tend to be more of a humanities guy than a STEM guy, and in fact, you know, I've had conversations with Suresh Caramella, the president of the University of Vermont, where I know his background is in the sciences and so on, and I'm often asking him questions like, well, what about English and history and all those things, but I only say that to preface this question, which is that among these three campuses, there's one that is really unique in the sense that there's no other public school, certainly in Vermont, offering similar courses, and that's VTC. I mean, we don't have we don't have the that 2+2 agriculture program based at Johnson or Linden. We don't have the training that our state highway engineers get from a lot of them go to the VTC and come out and they end up designing our next road projects and that kind of thing. And so I was surprised, frankly, to see that that there would be a closure there because it has it does stuff that just isn't available as much elsewhere. Did that strike you as strange, too?
It did, and for a couple of reasons. One is that, over the last couple of years, Jeb Spaulding had come numerous times to the legislature to warn us about the financial situation of the system. Each time he would come, my committee would advocate with him for increased funding. If you go back a few years ago, VTC was looking at bankruptcy. And in fact, Dan Smith was brought in as a kind of turnaround president on a short-term basis. He did a great job with some extra money from the legislature, and VTC came back into the black. But it had a history of financial issues. It shed some faculty and some other jobs, and no one was happy about that. But it seemed as though it was on a path to sustainability. In none of those discussions had Randolph been mentioned as a place that might experience a closure. So I had thought that the trustees were centering around the idea of consolidating NVU onto one campus. And so when the actual press release came out, I was shocked, to put it bluntly. Because you're right, I don't know where you would go if you wanted that sort of technical education in Vermont at the post-secondary level.
Yeah, I mean, it's not much else out there really for those, those specific kinds of, that specific kind of training. I also wondered whether into cases of Johnson and Linden, those schools the merger between those two campuses, I've struggled to understand from some perspectives because just geographically, I don't know how far exactly Linden is from Johnson, but it's a ways.
Dave, let me put it this way. It's a lot closer than Castleton. And the Chancellor's plan called for consolidating onto the Castleton campus, which again, had many people just scratching their head. But, the financial reality, again, is just horrific in the short term for VTC. We've agreed broadly to come in with as much as $25 million to stabilize the system over the next year. But some of the decisions that they made seem to have been driven by these brutal financial realities. So it's easy for me to make a joke about it, but they've struggled with it for months, and now it's our turn to join in that struggle. My hope is that what we come out with by December meets the, it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be a decision that will make everybody happy, but hopefully it's a healthier decision for the state and those communities than the Chancellor's original plan.
Yeah, I will say though that Jeb Spaulding has been on my program a couple, three, four times in the past couple of years, and he has tried to raise an alarm about the non-sustainability of this institution, these institutions. And last year, of course, he came to the legislature with a plan to try to get, $25 million in funding over 5 years. He said would bring it up on par with other, as he puts it, non-flagship public institutions in New England, and New England's not the strongest region in the country, by the way, in terms of its support for higher ed, for public higher ed, I should say.
Absolutely.
I've got a I mean I I just have to note that here that he has been trying to raise an alarm for a while. You know, didn't get a whole lot of results last year. I think he got $2.5 million in additional funding, which if you think of 25 over 5 years, that's about half what he asked for. Yeah. And no problem. And I'm understanding that they were looking at likely level funding this year. So really not getting the answer he thought was needed. So
right. And if I could just say one thing, you've in Vermont, we have record levels of students who graduate from high school. We're really among the top in the nation graduating people from 12th grade. Then we are one of the worst in the nation in terms of the rate who go on to college or some program for a 2-year certificate. And, you know, what I would say about that is it's not rocket science. We pay among the lowest into the system. As a result, the tuition is among the highest. So those two numbers, the amount that we put into the system to subsidize it and the low number of kids who go on, they are directly linked. If we made tuition significantly cheaper, we would have many more kids who go on to the state college system. It's really that simple, even in a world as complex as online hybrid delivery.
Yeah, it is. I also see this as pretty counterintuitive, given all the talk in the last couple of years about efforts to recruit more young people to move into Vermont to try to give us, reverse our economic, or rather demographic decline that has actually seen us lose population over the past 10 years. And I know the colleges traditionally are a pipeline into a local or regional economy. And I'm just wondering, what do you think about, is there a disconnect there?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, it was at one time during the Douglas administration, it was called the lost generation. So you have students moving out of the state for various reasons, one of which might be that they can get free tuition if they move to New York. But you also have fewer students moving into the state because it's so expensive to go to the state colleges here, especially as an out-of-stater. So if you make it cheaper to go here, I think that's one obvious way to do it. But that doesn't get rid of our system design problem. We have to be operating residential campuses in a way that's smart and sustainable. So one of the questions is, in a world where right now, even as we speak, every class everywhere is being delivered online. That's a first in history, and this experience is not going to go away. So institutes of higher ed, high schools, elementary schools, middle schools, they're all going to reconsider for the long term how they use online courses. And in short, they're going to use a lot more of them. So one of the questions is residential higher ed still going to be a sustainable proposition? Probably not at the number of campuses we have currently. So again, the question is, can we save one, two, or three of the campuses? I doubt we can save all of them.
I wonder also, are schools going to, and maybe some are already doing this, but is there going to be a growing trend in higher ed to say to kids, hey, spend your first 2 years after high school at home taking all the courses you can online and then come here to campus for your later 2 years or vice versa, whatever the plan might be. But as a savings, you know, certainly in terms of room and board and so on, with higher ed having gotten so expensive, that might be a way to trim costs some and might be an offering that would be attractive to people.
Absolutely. And a variation on what you're describing is low residency programs, which are very popular in the U.S. at this point, partially because they're conducted remotely for most of the year. So you do online or you do email or teleconferences with your professors, and then you come to campus for a month or 2 weeks in the summertime. That's a low residency program. They usually charge almost full price for that kind of program. So the question really is, will all of higher ed start to look less residential, maybe with you know, programs for part of the year on campus and part of the year at home.
Yeah, these are all ideas that I'm sure will be knocked around in the coming months and years, and we'll have to see what sugars off, as they say, over time. Senator Phil Baruth is the chair of the Vermont Senate's Education Committee.
I was on ag for 2 years. Let me tell you.
There, maybe that's why I had that in my brain somewhere. But I appreciate you joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. When we return, we're going to be talking with Bruce Post. He's a historian of government and of higher education funding, and maybe he's got some thoughts on how we got into this mess and how we can get out of it. We'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Well, you know, we've been thinking a lot about the state college system in Vermont certainly in the last week or so, because it was a week ago today that Chancellor Jeb Spaulding launched a now withdrawn proposal to close three campuses, the Northern Vermont University campuses in Johnson and Linden and the Vermont Technical College campus in Randolph Center. That proposal, shall we say, has not been well received, but it has served to highlight and put front and center in many Vermont people's minds the dire straits in which our state college system has found itself in recent years. And I've sort of wondered over the past week or so, well, how did we get into this situation and how do we get out of it? And sometimes it helps to turn to someone who is familiar with the history, going back a few decades, to learn what we can about certainly the how we got into it part, and maybe from that take some lessons on how we get out of it. And joining me on the phone this morning is Bruce Post. Bruce lives in Essex. He is someone who's been involved in government for a long time. He actually was an educational aide to former U.S. Representative and Senator Jim Jeffords. He worked with on national education and higher education matters for U.S. Senator Robert Stafford. He also was policy director for Governor Richard Snelling, and quite a few high-ranking posts there in government. Very knowledgeable about how government has functioned and how it has tried over the years to fund and keep its relation going with higher education. Bruce Post is on the phone with me this morning. Good morning, Bruce. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Dave, can you hear me fine?
I can hear you just fine. Yep.
Thank you. I'm sorry that we're not in the studio together, face-to-face, down there in beloved WDEV. What a great resource for the state of Vermont. And like I said, thanks. You've sort of created a living room for your listeners in this crisis, and I really appreciate it. Let me just say one thing real quick. I know Phil Baruth. I have a lot of respect for Phil Baruth. I hope he has a lot of respect for me. We're not chums, but we interact enough that we know who each other is. He had one quote. I just have to disagree with it. It's that simple. Well, there are so many moving parts in higher education and post-secondary education. It's not that simple. It really isn't. It is complex, and I think we have to admit that right up front. And the second thing I also want to talk about, I just don't want to talk about campuses and buildings. I want to talk about people. And
sure.
And we'll get into that a minute when I talk about how Dean Davis sort of set Vermont on the path it's on now. And we can do that. But I want to read you a quote, and I'm going to give you a quiz, okay?
All right. Uh-oh.
So listen carefully, man.
I'm listening. Yep.
In the general educational confusion, the problems of higher education occupies a peculiar an unfortunate position. When higher education is discussed, the matter is resolved at once into a question not of the public interest or of the relation of higher education to the whole system of education, but of the private and detached interests of rival colleges. Hitherto, the struggle for legislation in Montpelier, nominally for higher education, has been virtually a lobbying scramble for votes in the interest of one college against another. This has been the greatest misfortune of higher education in Vermont in the past and will become the chief obstacle to progress in the present conflict unless large-minded representatives of the college agree to put an end to the squabble forever. So when do you think that was written? Just take a guess.
I'm going to say sometime in the 1950s.
1915. 1915 in the Vermont Advance, which was a weekly paper in Burlington. So here's my theme for our next 20 minutes or so. It's from Ecclesiastes in the Old Hebrew Testament. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun.
Under the sun. Yeah.
And that sort of underwrites what we'll talk about this morning. And I also not just want to talk about the history. I want to talk about some shocking statistics I came around and maybe talk about a possible solution. But we've gone around and around and around on this forever. I consider the modern era of post-secondary education in this state really, I believe, began during the governorship of Phil Hoff. Even at that time, in the 60s, Norwich and Middlebury were getting payments from the state. It wasn't much, but they were getting payments from the state. We were on the verge of the Great Society. And Vermont started an experiment in guaranteeing loans to students that wanted to go to college. It would be through local banks. And then Phil Hoff started VSAC, the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, where I worked at the end of my career for about 12 years. And it was a revolutionary development. And then the feds came along and passed the Higher Education Act. And it may have been 64. And when I started at Norwich in 1965, I had one of the earliest federal college loans. It took me 10 years to pay it off later, but I did that successfully. And then Dean Davis came along in 1969. He was elected. He was 68 years old. Peter Martin, who was his executive assistant and who used to run, his family used to own Channel 3, called Dean Davis an impossibly old man. And we thought of him as an old man then. At 72, he seems a little young. I'm 72. There was an educational crisis or a budget crisis in the state. A lot of demand for services, but did Vermont have the resources to supply them all? And the state college has been under fire for years. During the campaign of 62, Linden State became an issue because former Governor Ray Keyser, or while he was governor, proposed or endorsed a plan to sell Linden State or lease it to a private entity. And I think they had the agreement of the president of Linden State. So Davis appointed a commission, in 1969, chaired by this Ray Keyser, who lost to Phil Hoff. They began to develop some ideas. And in 71, there was some budget problems in the state of Vermont. And Davis, in recommending his budget to the state, froze everything, kept it just the way it was, level funding. There were a few small programs, but there were two programs he proposed investing a lot in social welfare, particularly for mothers with children. And then he proposed doubling the budget for the Vermont Grant Program. People call it the VSAC grant, but that's state money. It's not VSAC's money. It's the state of Vermont's money. The state makes a decision. So it doubled it from about $1.4 million then, which seems like a scant amount, to about $2.8 million. And the philosophy Davis was trying to get across, we can only do so much. And the most important thing we should do is focus on people, focus on the students, focus on their hopes, and make sure through need-based education that Vermonters who are as not well off as others have the means through need-based student aid grants to attend post-secondary education. And it was admitted that you would have to raise tuitions in the state colleges at UVM, but that students who could afford to pay would have to pay a bit more, but those that couldn't afford to pay would come in on a need-based basis. And that was a recognition of we didn't have enough money to fully fund the post-secondary, public post-secondary education institutions in the state of Vermont. It was called the Vermont Model. It was also called high tuition, high aid. And unfortunately, what we've seen as the years have gone by, tuitions stayed high and gotten higher, but aid is not high aid anymore. It might be lukewarm aid or low aid. And mm-hmm. that's part of the problem. And then the feds have their programs. So this was what Davis's idea. And yet the state still struggled. There was this sense that we were underfunding our institutions. So in 1970, the Smallwood Commission was established. I don't know if you knew Frank Smallwood. He was a professor at Dartmouth and a Vermont state senator, a really wonderful guy. I knew him pretty well. And during the days of Madeline Cunin, she appointed a commission. It was chaired by Churchill Hines, again, a great public servant. And that made some recommendations. Howard Dean came along in the 90s because he was mad at the executive director of VSAC getting an 8% pay increase, and he took a shot at him. The guy's name was Don Vickers, and yet he really missed, and he started looking at that Vermont State Grant Program that was so popular with people in this state and wanted to take it away from VSAC and give it to the colleges. And they had a study group says, we can't do this better than VSAC. So we keep repeating and getting back to the same issues time and time and time again, just like Ecclesiastes said. And so that's a bit of the history. And
well, let me interject here for a minute, Bruce, and just ask you. I mean, there are other forces in play too. I understand which were not probably as extant back in the 70s, and one would be the or 80s, 90s even. But one is this demographic challenge where there are just fewer kids coming out of the high schools. Secondly, there's significantly a new kind of competition out there where, Phil Baruth mentioned Southern New Hampshire University, which is an online program, which is attracting an awful lot of interest and, frankly, a lot of students who might previously have gone to one of our residential campuses here in Vermont. And I'm wondering if you add those factors into this historic repeated pattern, as you call it, it's not a good mix, is it?
Well, obviously, every era has its different challenges. I agree with Senator Baruth that we need to look at this comprehensively. However, his deadline of December is a little troubling. That's a short period of time to do this. I got a text from a friend of mine who is involved in higher education, not in the state, but he lives here in Vermont. He said, I'm listening to the radio show while working, and I'm hearing from the Senate Ed Chair saying they hope to have an answer by 12:20 or Christmas. And they, his comment is, if you're a high school senior, why would you ever consider one of those listed to close? Talk about an enrollment disaster. So, and remember Trinity College closed, oh, it was around 1999. They brought in a guy from out of state who had been a college president, and he started talking about, we may have to close. And then I understand that applications for Trinity plummeted, so it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that's a little rushed to try to make a decision by Christmas, but I also agree that we have to bring in, convene, and fund well, not do it on a dime, a real forensic examination of the higher education community in the state of Vermont. You know, and I'm not confident necessarily that the legislature can do it. The legislatures continue to kick the can down the road, when I was in Congress, I used staff to oversee something called impact aid. People would complain, you know, that these Air Force bases or Army bases or large federal institutions, you know, didn't get taxed. It really hurt them. So we should pay money to them to host these bases. But then they try closing them, and it says, no, they're too much of a benefit to us, like Plattsburgh Air Force Base was closed. Yeah. And then they developed something called the BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, to at least have another set of eyes, as Phil Baruth said, take a look at it, and move things towards a decision. It didn't take the decision out of the Congress's hands, but it it really tried to depoliticize it as much as possible. Well, I wouldn't call this a College Realignment and Closure Commission. I might call it the Higher Education Realignment or Reconsideration Opportunity or HERO. That's something we could do, but it has to be done right. It has to be done with enough resources to do it. You have to look at the statistics, the finances and the statistics for enrollment on a campus-by-campus basis, and look at trends and whatever else these folks might want to consider. So I think that's a longer-term issue, and it's a slightly different approach than I think, you know, than a committee appointed by a governor or a committee of legislators. And, you know, I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah. And, Bruce, I got an email during the break from a listener. You were mentioning before the break that what we're going to need to do is a pretty serious injection of cash money into our higher education system to sort of keep it going while we figure out how it should be configured in the future. And the question from this listener, Chris Vienz of Waterbury, basically asking, well, taxpayers are already overburdened in Vermont. Where are we going to get this money?
Well, first of all, I didn't say that we should put an infusion of cash, a high infusion of cash into the system. If we're going to do a study, I think we need to fund that appropriately, and that's much less money. We do these studies sometimes, and we try to get through it on the cheap. So I wasn't saying we have to put a high infusion of cash into the system. That's a decision that would have to be made later on. And again, I subscribe to the Vermont model. If we fund financial aid high enough, that here's a way of trying to find this kind of zone, they call it the Goldilocks zone, where we can afford our system, but also, you know, not overly spend money on it. And I want to, you know, I know we're getting done soon, but I think we need to be concerned with this, what's happening outside of what they call the Montpelier-Burlington bubble. I have a lot of friends that live all over the state, and they think so much policy is developed from environmental stuff to post-secondary education to health care that revolves around that Montpelier-Burlington bubble, and particularly Chittenden County and its institutions. And, you know, and when I was in North Dakota Cass County, where Fargo was called King Cass. Well, in a way, we've got Lord Chittenden here. A lot of my folks in rural Vermont think Chittenden County likes to lord it over everybody. And one thing we haven't mentioned is the University of Vermont in this. It's all about the state colleges. And I found a statistic the other day that just snowed me. And in the fall of 2010, and I got this through the UVM website, in-state enrollment, Vermonters attending university, all their different divisions, 5,324. By the fall of 2019, it was 4,182, so a loss of 1,142 Vermonters, while out-of-state enrollment went from 8,230 to 9,366, a considerable gain. And also, we forget that in 1966, total enrollment at UVM was 10,146, and now, when the fall of 2019, it was 13,548. And a lot of that growth has been out-of-staters come in who are probably paying a lot more, and Vermonters not going for whatever reason. I think we have to, again, let's focus on people. And we also have to focus on financial aid policies within the universities themselves. They have this science called enrollment management, which is strange algorithms that enable universities to tweak things to try to maximize their revenues, get the kind of student body they need, and provide as little financial aid as possible. It sounds like cynical stuff, but that's the reality. We got criticized. Go ahead, Dave.
I hate to cut you off because this is interesting stuff, but I must tell you, we are at about the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, so I'm going to have to leave it there, but I really appreciate you joining me this morning. We'll have to continue this conversation at another time, and thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Dave. Bye-bye.
Alrighty, we are going to go to our top of the hour break for some CBS news and a couple words from our sponsors. Afterward, we'll be talking with one of our national correspondents, Bob May, and then we're going to have a conversation with some folks who are involved in a fundraising effort for Vermont's musicians. You've heard the phrase struggling musician. Well, boy, is it the case now where nobody's got a gig because of all the social distancing. We'll be back after this top of the hour break coming up, folks. Stay with us.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and the Dave Graham Show is always happy to bring in Bob Ney. He's one of our national correspondents. I expect he'll be joining us very shortly. I was just told not yet. He calls in on Fridays after the mid-show break, and we get to check in with Bob, and he has some really good, interesting perspective and insights on the national news scene out there and how things are playing politically and so on. Of course, Bob is a former member of Congress who got himself in a little trouble with the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal, for those who remember that in the early 2000s, ended up seeing the inside of a federal correctional facility for a little while, and has emerged as a commentator, including on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And I think that range of perspectives, I mean, you don't get much higher in life in America or lower in life than Congress and federal prison. So these are two locations in our society that are that's kind of at the opposite ends, one might almost think. But there you go. It happens occasionally. And in the case of Bob Ney, this really, I think, has helped to give him a very interesting and broad perspective on things and on politics and on the world of the possible and the world of the likely and so on and so forth. While we have a couple minutes, I'm going to just note here that some parts of the world are continuing to turn. The NFL has just had its first ever virtual draft. Commissioner Roger Goodell was booed virtually by fans. I mean, I do have to laugh. That guy is, he seems to be a punching bag. But anyway, Bob Ney, what do you make of that? Roger Goodell being booed virtually by fans during the NFL draft. What is up with that?
I put that in my notes to you today. Normally, and I was watching this with some friends of mine last night, and they're like, you know, he's going to get booed virtually because every year when he's live, they boo him. I don't know why, but they do. So he knew it was coming. And last night he turned around and he said, oh, OK, come on, boo louder, basically. So it's just a tradition to boo him.
It's kind of funny. I mean, of all the sort of leaders of our major league sports leagues and so on. I mean, you look at a guy like Adam Silver with the NBA. Now, there's a guy who doesn't get booed, and it just comes across as somebody who's pretty serious and very thoughtful and smart and borderline intellectual and so on and so forth. Whereas Goodell has always, I think, struck a lot of people as kind of a buffoon. But boy, you know, I just sometimes wonder, why does he take all this abuse? And then I remember his salary is something in the millions annually.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, they can chant, you know, that on me all day long if they pay me what he makes. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, Bob, well, we got the latest on the coronavirus here. You know, the toll continues to rise. The U.S. is going to hit 50,000 deaths today. I seem to remember that was roughly the number in Vietnam, right? The total length of that war, which went on for something like 12 years or something.
Right. And so, then each state, of course, is different. My home state of Ohio is about 540 people. We don't have a rush to the hospitals. In fact, some of our hospitals, my local hospital, you could shoot a cannonball through it and not injure anybody, which is making doctors say, hey, I want to go back to work, you know, because they stopped elective procedures, and the hospitals are basically empty. But you go to New York, it'll be a different world.
Yeah, I some of these decisions do need to be made with a little more nuance and a little more a local response to local conditions. So, and you know, one of the strange aspects about this, you hear people saying, and sometimes at these demonstrations now that have been popping up around the country demanding a reopening of the economy, that you know, we've had wars in the past that actually have cost more lives than this thing has cost, and you know, I think the underlying message there is that people have gone to war in the past for the American way of life, and a lot of that meaning basically the American economy, and maybe that's what we need to do here, and this is all part of the sacrifice. Again, Vietnam cost 50-something thousand lives over the course of, again, 12 years or longer. This has been 50,000 lives in a couple of months.
Right. And I think the problem we probably have as a country, Dave, is that, you know, the closures are different. I'll just give you a quick example. I live on the West Virginia-Ohio border, right? And in that area, if you go to Walmart in Wheeling, West Virginia area, you must have a mask or you can't go in. You can only go in the grocery section. If you come over across the river to Ohio to the Walmart, that's not the same scenario. You can shop anywhere. There's differences. You can't buy liquor in Pennsylvania, West Virginia. You can in Ohio. So, you know, each state has its nuances, as you said, and each state has different problems. Then you go to Michigan, where, just to be frank about this, and this is not a red state, she banned you buying garden seed.
I'm sorry, we're kind of went overboard. Getting choppy here, Bob, on the cell phone. We're kind of getting choppy here. You said you go to Michigan, and what's happening there?
Oh, in Michigan, the governor banned, you know, if you want to plant a garden.
Planting a garden?
Yes, if you wanted to plant a garden, you couldn't go buy seeds or plants. And yeah. If you had two homes, like a vacation home, you had to choose which home. You couldn't go to both. Some things like that caused a backlash. Other things she did were okay, you know.
Yeah, I know that Governor Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan has gotten a lot of pushback, and I mean some of the earliest and most vehement of the sort of anti-quarantine demonstrations were in Lansing, going back to last week, I guess, and so we're in the situation now where people are starting to get impatient, but meanwhile the Anthony Faucis of the world are saying, more patience is going to be needed for months to come.
Right. My governor is Republican in Ohio, Mike DeWine. He had one of the first shutdowns. And, Michigan has a higher death rate than we have. So, each state has a different thing. He's had some pushback, but he stayed pretty firm in what he's doing.
Yeah, that's my sense, is that DeWine has been fairly aggressive about this, especially if you were just to take him in the class of Republican governors out there, some of whom, you look at what's going on in Georgia, and, I just hope that folks in Georgia are going to be okay, frankly. I think they're, I think they are taking some risks that, are clearly not being taken elsewhere, at least not yet, and so
we'll
see what happens.
On Georgia, Dave, the president kind of drove the bus over the governor and then drove it back over him. I mean, the governor got signals from the White House to go ahead and do what he did, and then the White House, they changed the president's mind, and then the governor was out there in a cold, lonely place.
Yeah, boy, that if I were that governor, I would not be happy with that situation.
I wouldn't either.
But, I guess the president maybe thought, hey, here's a first-term governor who we can probably sacrifice this guy for whatever reason. But North Korea, is Kim still alive, or what's going on there?
We don't know. We think, from what we know from press reports, he's had heart surgery and he's not in good condition. I think they're keeping it quiet because his sister is trying to maybe thwart off a military coup, and then she would take control of the country herself. So I don't think he's in good shape. Even the Chinese don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's amazing how, if you want for any reason to keep what's going on in your government secret, North Korea's got the formula here.
That's it.
I mean, it's just incredible the degree to which, we have had situations in the past where there was a lack of information flowing out from, I remember reading a terrific essay by A.J. Liebling, who was a longtime media critic, really a newspaper back in the day, a critic for The New Yorker. And he had this hilarious piece about all the speculation surrounding the final days of, I think it was Joseph Stalin. And he was quoting all these headlines, talking about how Stalin was dead. No, he's still alive, and et cetera, et cetera. It was a pretty funny piece, but I don't think we're quite in that realm yet with Kim here. But I do think that in terms of the overall impact on international affairs, though, do you think it's likely that his sister would take over, or is there some other succession that might happen?
No, I think she'll take over. I think if something happens to him, she'll keep the bloodline going. She's the natural one. I think he had a brother, but they killed him. So it would be his sister.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see what happens. I don't know. I think every time I think about that guy, I think about my son's great line, which is that he said that if Kim and Trump ever went mano a mano, he's betting on the fat guy with the weird hair. So... Anyway, pretty safe bet, I'd say. All right. Well, Bob Nave, thank you so much for joining me,
and we'll
talk to you soon. Take care. I wanted to end the week. It's been kind of a tough week in terms of just the more coverage of the coronavirus pandemic, obviously, and the whole controversy surrounding the Vermont State College system and so on. I wanted to end on a positive note, and there are an awful lot of Vermonters out there doing really good work right now just to help their neighbors and try to keep folks they know and admire on the keep them in groceries and keep them in maybe a roof over their heads and that sort of thing. Very, very tough economy out there right now, just thousands and thousands of layoffs. One of the situations out there, which are really tough on folks right now, are many people in Vermont have made a living for pretty much their whole adult lives in lines of work that don't sort of have the normal paycheck and benefits and unemployment insurance and all of those things. We have folks who are artisans. They bring their crafts to fairs and to other events, farmers markets and so on, and make a significant part of their living, or pretty much their whole living, from doing some beautiful work there, contributing a lot to the quality of life here in Vermont, but they typically are not real well compensated. Another type of worker who I will say is also contributes an awful lot to the general beauty of the world are musicians. And musicians are folks who may have been the original and almost inventors of the gig economy. I think the word gig actually started in the music world. And these folks are really struggling right now because obviously with all the social distancing and the bans on large gatherings going on, we are not able to go out and hear live music much these days. And so musicians have been getting all of their upcoming gigs canceled, or the vast majority of them anyway. A few things happening online, but not the same. And so musicians are struggling. You've heard the phrase struggling musician probably in the past. It's really maybe in hyperdrive right now, that situation of folks who are really, really struggling right now. Thankfully, as in so many other realms in Vermont, people are stepping up to try and help. And among the efforts to try to help some of the musicians in the state, we have the Seven Stars Arts Center, which is based in Sharon, and a couple of folks who make musical instruments. We have a violin maker from Chelsea, Vermont, Jacob Brillhart, and a bow maker from East Montpelier, Eben Bodak-Turner. And they are joining me along with the Seven Stars Art Center's Emerson Gale. The three of them are on the phone this morning. And to the three of you, I wish you a good morning. And thank you so much for joining me. And kudos to the work you're doing to try to help musicians out there around Vermont. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dave.
Let me start with you, if I could, Emerson. You were the one who reached out to me about what this effort here, and tell us a little bit about the Seven Stars Art Center and what you all do in normal times and what you're doing now.
Hey, thanks so much, Dave. Yeah, so Seven Stars Art Center has loved this opportunity to help support musicians in this difficult time for them with the great gig collapse, as you mentioned. And primarily, we've really been a nonprofit arts organization focused around musicians. Most of our folks that come through here, they come for our concerts. We have a lot of local Vermont musicians come in, people from around New England, touring acts from up north and beyond. So, you know, when the pandemic, the lockdown hit, we started to think, well, what can we do to help musicians? Because, you know, that's most of our people. Of course, we also offer, you know, Tai Chi, yoga classes, sculpture, et cetera, and working with local schools in the Sharon area there in the Upper Valley to, you know, help kids and adults, families connect more with arts. And the local musicians, for which you like just noted, bring that extra sense of beauty to our life here in Vermont, and also important medicine in these times of, you know, more stress in our lives. There's nothing like a good, you know, Scottish air to calm the system, right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, and you got connected up with the violin maker in Chelsea, Jacob Brillhart. And Jacob, I wanted to check in with you about this. Is this a full-time, lifelong career for you to make violins? I'm not familiar with your work in that regard.
Yes. Yeah, I'm a professional violin maker. It's what I do full time is making violins. And I'm from Vermont, and then I was living in Boston for a while, and now I've moved back up to Vermont a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's good to be back, and it's, yeah.
Wow. And tell me a little bit about the violin making craft. And by the way, I gather that makes you a luthier, is that right?
Yeah, that's a term a lot of folks use. Yep.
To apply to makers of stringed instruments, from what I understand, and tell how many violins do you make in the course of a year, and where do you typically sell them? And tell me a little bit about the work as it normally proceeds.
Yeah, it's common to make, you know, between maybe 8 and 12 instruments a year. You know, it's a slow process. It's you're starting with maybe 10 pounds of wood, and over the course of many hours, you know, turning that into a 1 pound instrument. And you know, there's somewhere around 70 pieces of wood that all go into one finished violin. So it takes a long time. There's also a lot of tension in an instrument. You know, the string tension and the pressure of the strings pressing down on the top of the violin is a lot of weight. And so, you know, the string tension can be around 60 pounds of tension. And so there's always this balance of trying to make the violin light enough to vibrate and sound good and strong enough to hold together for centuries. And that's, mm-hmm. that's kind of the whole name of the game with violin making. And so
what kind of wood is a violin typically made out of?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the top plate is spruce, and it's European spruce that comes from generally like the northern Italian region. And the back and the sides and the neck are all made out of European maple, which is different from the American maple. It's a little lighter and it's a little more supple.
Wow, huh? And how did you learn this craft? What did you do to study it?
So there's a school down in Boston, the North Bennett Street School, and they teach a variety of trades, including jewelry making and furniture making and restoration carpentry. They also have a violin making program. And so I went there and I studied with the master violin maker who teaches at that program.
And when you finish work on a violin and get ready to sell it so you can make a living, what's typically your main market?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I sell through shops that are around the country, and then I also sell some to directly to players. Being in Vermont, there's definitely a market for players to some extent in Vermont. But it's also, the nature of the business allows me to, to make an instrument and then pack it up, ship it halfway across the country and, sell it through a shop that's somewhere in a totally different location. So I do a lot of that as well. And it's a balance between the two.
So you have joined with Evan Bodock-Turner, Vise Montpelier, who's a bow maker, and we're going to talk with Evan in just a moment. But the two of you, oh, and by the way, also contributing this to this effort is a violin shop down in southern Vermont. The name has escaped me at the moment, but they're contributing a case for
David Baker. Yep.
The Baker Violin Shop, which is in Dummerston, is it? Or
yes. Yep.
Okay, and they are contributing a case to this effort, and the whole purpose here is to raffle off the violin, the bow, and the case, and raise money to provide $250 grants to musicians who apply for this program. Evan Bodock-Turner. You make bows. Is this a full time job for you?
Yeah, it is. It's
wow.
Sort of a niche within a niche.
Yeah. Well, we, I'm always amazed at the variety of ways Vermonters make a living. And I hear about stuff, and I go, I never even would have thought of that. But there we go. There's someone right here in East Montpelier who's a bow maker by profession. So
yeah,
we can talk.
Many of us. No.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about it after a little break. We've got to go to here at the bottom of the hour. We do a little CBS News Minute, a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll continue our conversation with bow maker Evan Bodock-Turner, Emerson Gale of the Seven Stars Arts Center. And we'll be back in just a moment. Yeah, we'll be back in just a minute, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and my guests are Emerson Gale of the Seven Stars Art Center, based in Sharon, Vermont. Also, Jacob Brillhart is a violin maker based in Chelsea, Vermont, and Evan Bodak-Turner makes bows for stringed instruments in East Montpelier, Vermont. And the three of them have joined together to create a violin and have gotten a donation of a case from the Baker Violin Shop in Dummerston, Vermont. And they are raffling this off for the violin, the case, the bow, for a fundraiser for musicians who are struggling even beyond what normally it's not an easy living for a lot of folks who love music and want to do it and are doing it and oftentimes not getting rich at it, but they are struggling to get by. And these days it's a lot worse because all the gigs have dried up. There's no big social gatherings out there for going to listen to live music, and boy, that really puts a big crimp on anybody's music career. And so anyway, the three of these gentlemen are talking with us a little bit about the work they do. And Evan Bodak-Turner of East Montpelier, you were talking about your bow making craft. Do I recall correctly that the soft material that actually is that horse hair?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's sort of been the choice for bows since the very beginning, and people have tried to come up with alternatives, and it's never worked out. It's kind of one of those things that the natural material is just the best choice.
And is that true of the strings as well on the instrument?
Strings have evolved a lot. They started out as gut, and have moved towards synthetics and metals.
Hmm. And so, but the bows actually are still made with horsehair. And I don't gather you keep a herd of horses in East Montpelier to trim their tails or something.
No,
and
I think
gather
my
your
daughter
hair.
Would like that, but no, most of the hair comes from China, Mongolia, Siberia. Cold,
wow.
even colder than here, makes for a more elastic, even strand of hair.
Wow. And is the hair, I mean, now I'm going off on a little bit of a hairy tangent here, no pun intended. Well, okay. But the horsehair, I mean, is that actually taken from the coat of the animal all over, or is it just the tail, or what's the,
just,
where
just
do you...
the tail. You need a minimum of 31, 32 inches of hair to fill a bow.
Wow!
And so it has to be tail hair,
and as in each hair has to be 31 or 32 inches long.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it's a big industry in China. It's a craft of sorting hair. Hair has a lot of purposes, both artistic and industrial, and sorting hair for color and length. And the hair I buy is highly sorted, so that it's very even and consistent, both in its taper and its diameter, one hair to the next, and things like that. But they're literally sorted one hair at a time.
This is fascinating stuff, I gotta say. I had no idea that there's so much to it, and that you've got to go to Asia to get the right stuff. I guess. And is that been the case from, you know, all the way back to the old Europe violin makers? You know, I think of Stradivarius and people like that. Were they getting their horsehair from Asia as well, or?
I guess I can't say for certain, but I suspect that early on it was not. Probably not feasible, because you're talking about the you know, the 15th century or 16th century when that would have been starting to be used. But, you know, and I think also the importance put in the bow really didn't come around until the 19th, you know, early 19th century.
When you make these bows, are you making them purely for violins, or do you make cello and viola bows and so on also?
Yeah, all violin family. So violin, okay. Viola, cello, and I also make double bass bows, yeah.
Wow. Are they, I would gather they are like different sizes and so on, right?
Yeah, that's right. So as the instrument goes down in pitch, the mass of the string goes up. And the more mass of the string, the more energy from the bow it takes, and so the more weight you need. So the bows, typically a violin bow starts around 60 grams, and you add 10 grams for the viola and again for cello, and then bass bows are all over the map. They're up in the 140s often.
Wow.
Yeah.
These grams are measuring just the hair, right? Or
no
the overall.
In fact, the hair is sort of an incidental. It's like the oil in your car. It gets changed regularly if you're doing things right. The stick and the frog and the button. So the frog is the piece under your hand where the hair is attached. The other end of the stick would be called the head. That's where the other end of the hair is attached. And the button is the adjuster that tightens it.
And did you say the frog also?
Yeah, so the frog it's made of ebony. It's stands up off of the stick and holds the hair so that when you tighten the hair, it will tension the hair with the stick.
So as you could tell by my ignorant questions, I'm not a string player, but I'd want to have some kind of an annual budget for replacing the bow hair on my instrument from time to time.
It's different for every player, depending on sort of how often they're playing and how picky they are about their sound. So hair is, if you're playing, you know, a professional player will often get a rehair as much as every 3 to 6 months.
Wow.
And but that said, you have other players who will have a rehair and then may not do it again for years. The hair will stay in the bow and it will continue to work. It won't sound as good as time goes by.
Yeah, and so when you do a rehair, do you go and buy the hair from you and do it yourself, or is this something that you drop the bow off and you do it over the course of a few days or whatever?
It's a fairly quick process if you've done a few thousand of them. If a player tried to do it themselves, it's not impossible, obviously, but it is hard to get good results unless you're doing it really, really regularly. It involves tying thread knots around each end of the hair at the proper length with the proper tension side to side. Across the hank. So there's a fair amount of practice and skill that goes into it. And for most players, that's not really where they want to invest their time.
Are you in the, tell me about the industry here. Do you serve basically all the string players in Vermont, or are there other bow makers out there to go to when you need new hair?
There are two of us, three of us here in the state.
Wow!
And that do it as the main part of their income. The work is spread around some, and we all sort of have slightly different focuses, but. Rehairs are something that we all do. And in fact, there are people in the violin shops who also do rehairs, but may not make bows.
I see. Okay.
Yep.
So, this is fascinating stuff to me. It's kind of one of these who knew adventures.
Yeah. And
I feel like I'm on.
Before we go yeah. too far, I wasn't alone in this process making this bow. A great friend of mine and colleague, Evan Orman, from Denver, actually made the stick for this bow.
I see.
And I made the frog and button.
Who's checking in with us now? I heard a couple of hellos.
Hey. Oh, sorry, my phone just went totally dead, and now it's back. So I'm
Sorry about that. Good
Is that
I
Jacob?
Didn't say anything I regret? Yes.
Okay. No. Yeah. All we heard were a couple of hellos, and that's fine. The FCC won't get after us for that. let me ask you, Jacob. You make violins. Do you also make bows yourself?
I do not. No, I don't. Okay. Usually in the profession, there's bow makers and there's violin makers, and they're totally different machines, so to speak. So.
Wow. I did not know this. I mean, is Eben your kind of your go-to guy?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yep. I send everyone I can send to him, and I grew up here in Vermont and playing violin, playing the fiddle, and so actually I was before I ventured into violin making and became a violin maker myself. I was going to Eben to get to have my work done and bought a bow from him and whatnot.
So. I see. And do you still play the violin, Jacob?
I do. Yes.
And what about you, Eben? Are you a musician as well as a craftsman?
Yeah, I'm a double bass player. So I play in a few local orchestras.
Oh, I see. Okay. And so, obviously the interest in this craft work then comes from a background in music for both of you.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I grew up playing and, started working in a shop, in high school. I've always liked to sort of tinker with things and know how things work and sort of the meeting of those two interests, and sort of went from there. And I think that's a story you hear over and over again from instrument and bow makers.
Yeah, it's certainly not, I wouldn't think it's something that's true of every musician. Different people have different talents, obviously, and not every musician is going to end up as a craftsperson, but I would think that there's probably significant overlap. I don't know whether the majority of bow makers are also stringed instrument players, but it wouldn't shock me to learn that. So, let me bring in Emerson here for a moment and ask you, Emerson, by the way, are you a musician yourself as well?
Hey, cheers. Yes. And that's actually how I met Jake, jamming at some local sessions here in the Upper Valley and hearing him just totally go for it with some Cape Breton tunes and being quite inspired to look up those tunes and start working on them myself. Still working on Miss Norman McKeegan, by the way, Jake. Still working on it. It's getting there. It's getting there. And great Cape Breton reel. And just like Eben mentioned that, we've had these other folks really come in and build this to be the grassroots fundraiser community effort that it's been, like with Eben Orman joining for the bow. I'd have to also mention that Turn Music, who you likely know of through Ann Decker and also the Montpelier Chamber Orchestra from the beginning, mm-hmm. have been great supporters within the Vermont community, of course, like the Upper Valley Music Center, Northeast Heritage Music Camp, Northeast Fiddlers Association. Just want to say Muskeg Music and Vermont Fiddle Orchestra. These are all, grassroots Vermont music organizations filled with musicians that we want to support, and a lot of folks who are supporting musicians through which, despite all the best efforts of myself with the board of the Seven Stars Art Center, and Jake's tireless work building the violin over live stream and likewise with Eben on the bow, without these, Vermont music organizations, this fundraiser wouldn't have been possible. So I want to also thank all of those musicians as well.
Wow. That's great. There's so much sort of coming together and participation in this. It's almost like putting together a band or an orchestra or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's a perfect metaphor for it.
Exactly. Slightly different project, but what the heck, right? Why not? My guests are Jacob Brilhart. He is a violin maker in Chelsea, Vermont. Eben Bodock-Turner is a bow maker in East Montpelier, Vermont. Emerson Gale is with the Seven Stars Art Center. All three are musicians. I gather, Emerson, you're a violinist, maybe, mainly a fiddler?
That's right. Yeah, especially as a music educator in the Upper Valley. I teach out of the Seven Stars Art Center, the Sharon Academy, and Upper Valley Waldorf School primarily, as well as home visits. And clearly, yeah, Vermont is a fantastic place to be a musician, a music educator. I feel extremely fortunate that most of my students and have been able to move online. But at the same time, it's just been so apparent that if you didn't already have a studio going, it's a little challenging to get one going just online if you were a touring musician. So there's, you know, a lot of amazing Vermont musicians who, understandably, in their schedule, they were traveling too much to have students and now, you know, are scrambling to figure out a new way of life. So we're glad that this raffle has been kicking off, which anyone can go check out at go.rallyup.com/musician aid, go.rallyup.com/musician aid, as a way for a lot of Vermont musicians. We've already been able to support over 100 musicians, and many of those are Vermonters, New Englanders, and you know, help them get some groceries, help them pay for rent in the meantime while they find other ways of, you know, making it work, right?
Yeah, that's the scramble right now for sure. The two violinists we have here, Emerson and Jacob, are you both more in the Cape Breton fiddling style, or do you do any sort of symphonic and orchestral work, or what's the sort of genre range here we're talking about?
Go for it, Jake.
Yeah. So I was trained in the Cape Breton tradition since I was a little kid by Beth Telford, who's a teacher in Braintree, Vermont. And it's kind of something that, you know, it's kind of been my lifelong musical love affair. And I play sometimes with some other folk musicians and stuff that are outside of that genre, but pretty much every time I end up coming back to Cape Breton music. Cape Breton is, for folks who don't know, it's a little island. It's a big island, actually, off the coast of Nova Scotia, with a very high density Scottish immigrant descendant population. And so it's a very Scottish sounding kind of music, but it's, mm-hmm. it's also very, you know, it's very down to earth, grassroots kind of society. So,
yeah, that's great. Let's see. That was Jacob. What about you, Emerson?
Yeah. So I have definitely been inspired by Cape Breton, but I feel like I have a lot of homework still to do. For me, my background is more in Quebecois, French-Canadian music, also north of the border here. And as our state mm-hmm. name is a French word, it feels appropriate, Vermont, right? Yeah.
Sure.
Green Mountain style. And but for me, I think it's especially a larger smorgasbord, if you will, of a goulash of fiddle tunes. Could be vegan goulash, by the way. I happen to be vegan, so why not as a metaphor? But anyways, I feel really indebted to some of my musical mentors, like David Kaner in the New England scene, which I discovered through the Vermont Fiddle Orchestra, really helped expose me to a lot of incredible dance music. And I got my start out in San Francisco with Alistair Fraser's guidance, the San Francisco Scottish Fiddlers. So I feel like the New England dance music scene is just so alive, and also a big part of why we've had this fundraiser. It's really driven by the movement of people dancing, and when they, you know, haven't been able to get out of their houses and go to contra and square dances together, they're looking online for forms of inspiration. And so it's been fun to see this also as, in a way, the dance community coming together. And just like the, you know, the dance community plays on Scottish, Irish, Cape Breton, Quebecois, old timey, Scandinavian, etc., you know, so many tunes from around the world. Likewise, we've seen how this project has brought all these musicians together within Vermont, but also outside of Vermont. We've even had musician applicants, not only from Canada, but also even a few from Europe, actually. And unfortunately, even at our fundraising level right now, we still have over 130 musician applicants we're not able to cover that are vetted in the queue and urgently need the funds. So we really appreciate folks. If you're in a fiddle, violin music, or, you know, the making of violins or bows, or, you know, anything related to that, and, you know, feel inspired to help musicians, we really appreciate the support so we can still cover those musicians who have applied.
And Evan, Bodoc Turner, East Montpelier based bow maker and double bassist, I think you said.
That's right.
What's your, tell me about genres in your life.
So I grew up here playing mostly in jazz band at U32. Mm-hmm. And then started playing with the Vermont Youth Orchestra through high school. And I went to music school. I have a music recording degree from Ithaca College. Mm-hmm. And there I played exclusively orchestral music.
I see.
And so really since college, I have focused almost exclusively on orchestral playing. I do play a fair amount of musical theater, you know, pit work also.
I see. Okay. And what orchestras are you playing in these days, or have you been before the pandemic hit?
Right. Most of my playing is with the Vermont Philharmonic and Montpelier Chamber Orchestra. Both tremendous community orchestras. You know, just an amazing group of people to be a part of. You know, these are people who have other careers and come together once a week leading up to concerts for, you know, 2 months or so before a concert, and really give a lot of their time and energy to these organizations, and just amazing communities. You know, Emerson said, and you've said, Vermont is an incredible place to be able to do something like this. With not a huge population, we accomplished some pretty amazing things.
Evan, let me ask you this: is Vermont exceptional in this regard, or are these kinds of orchestras and Cape Breton fiddling opportunities available all across the country, or is it a particular hotbed around here?
I think it is. I mean, I can't speak from tons of personal experience other than anecdotal talking to other people. But I think what makes this place very unique is the amount of support that these organizations get. All of these organizations, they don't just happen. People put a lot of energy in. The community supports them. They go to concerts. They help with fundraising campaigns. They serve on boards. For the number of people we have here, we just have a huge number. The idea that we have two community orchestras in central Vermont is remarkable.
That is
certainly outside of a city. It's an amazing thing.
We are fast running out of time here, unfortunately. I'd love to chat all day with you guys because this is great. But Evan, Jacob, and Emerson, the three of you, good luck with this effort you're doing here. Emerson, one last time, what's the website?
Hey, thanks so much for having us, Dave. Last time, it's go.rallyup.com/musician aid. Musician aid is one word. go.rallyup.com/musician aid. Raffle tickets start at $20 to support musicians in need. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's about it for the Dave Graham Show today. I thank my guests and tune in again Monday for another edition of our show. Stay tuned today, and we will be back Monday. Have a great weekend, folks.